Hello, this is Tracy, and welcome to ADHD for Smartass Women. Creating this podcast is a joy, but it's not without its costs. For 5 years, it's been free to consume, but not free to create. If you believe in what we're doing and want to help me continue, consider supporting the show with a one-time or ongoing donation at spyhappy.me/support. Your support, it means the world to me. It fuels our mission to change the conversation around ADHD in women and helps us create content that lights up our community with positive emotion, practical advice, and real relatable stories. Thank you for being such an amazing part of our community. Once again, the link is spyhappy.me/support. Richard Branson, Michael Phelps, Justin Timberlake, James Carville. Wait a minute. Where are the women? Greta Gerwig, Lisa Ling, Audra McDonald, Simone Biles. That sounds like a list of highly successful titans in a variety of industries. They all have ADHD, but you don't hear much about that now, do you? You know what else you don't hear about? Are the 43% of people with ADHD who are in excellent mental health. Why aren't we talking about them and what they're doing right? I'm your host, Tracy Otsuka, and that's exactly what we do here. I'm a lawyer, not a doctor, a lifelong student, and now the author of my new book, ADHD for Smartass Women. I'm also a certified ADHD coach and the creator of Your ADHD Brain is A-OK, a patented system that helps ADHD women just like you get unstuck and fall in love with their brilliant brains. Here, we embrace our too muchness and we focus on our strengths. My guests and I credit our ADHD for some of our greatest gifts. And to those who still think they're too much, too impulsive, too scattered, too disorganized, I say, no one ever made a difference by being too little. Hello, hello, hello. I'm your host, Tracy Otsuka. Thank you so much for joining me here for another episode of ADHD for Smart Ass Women. My purpose is always to show you who you are and then inspire you to be it. In the thousands of ADHD women that I've had the privilege of meeting, I've never met a one that wasn't truly brilliant at something, not one. So of course, I am just delighted to introduce you to Allison Larkin. Allison Larkin is the internationally best-selling author of the novels Stay, Why Can't I Be You, Swimming for Sunlight, and most recently, The People We Keep. Her short fiction has been published in the Somerset Review and Slice, and nonfiction in the anthologies I'm Not the Biggest Bitch in This Relationship and Author in Progress. She lives in the San Francisco Bay Area. We are totally going to have to talk about that with her husband, Jeremy, and their rescue dog, Roxy. Allison was diagnosed with attention deficit disorder at age 19 and didn't start writing until her mid-20s when she learned how to work with her brain to capture story ideas. Now she feels that her ADHD mind is her greatest asset as a novelist, and she's passionate about helping other people share their own creative process. Allison, welcome. I am just delighted to meet you. Did I get all of that right?
You did, and I'm so excited to meet you. I have to admit, I don't usually get nervous doing podcasts, but you changed my life. And so I've been so nervous, I'm just going to get on here and cry at you.
Oh my gosh. Of course, I love hearing that my work is making a difference, right? And we met on Instagram, didn't we?
Yes, we did.
I remember where I was. I was going into a coffee shop. I think it was right before some book event thing. And I don't know why, but you sent a lovely message. And I think you had read the book. And I responded. And I said, you said, oh, I'm an author. And I'm like, oh, you are? Just thinking, oh, you're an author. And then I went and kind of looked at what you did. And I'm like, wait a minute, you are really an author. And I'm going to be honest with you. I always read my guests' books. But I didn't realize you had more than one book. So I went to go by the people we keep. And I was reading the reviews and I am such a baby. I was like, I won't be able to get through this book. I can't get through this book because it's so intense, which is probably why it's been so highly reviewed and it's so good. So I'm going to apologize right up front, but I promise you, Allison, I would have been depressed for a year.
I understand.
I'm so hypersensitive about that, but I didn't realize you have other books, and your other books are much more light and funny, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Before we go there, sorry, I'm just, you know, because I'm so interested in what it is that you're doing. Let's start with your ADHD diagnosis. That's where I always start. So can you tell us, I know you were diagnosed when you were younger, what happened, all of it?
You know, I was one of those kids who started reading pretty early, and I read everything I could get my hands on, and I was in the top of my class. You know, I was the best, one of the best readers. And then puberty hit, and I got to junior high school. And I started really, really, really struggling and, you know, got the doesn't pay attention in class, doesn't apply herself kind of things. And so for the rest of my school career, I had a lot of really big inconsistencies. Like I would almost fail science and then do a science fair project where that I thought of myself, where I grew plants hydroponically and in dirt and studied the cell structure to see if it was different.
Mine was to classical music. One was rock and one was classical music to see if the difference.
Oh, that's so cool. Yeah. So I have those things where when I was super interested in something by my own motivation, I was there and ready to do it. And when I wasn't, I couldn't pay attention for anything. I had a really hard time with math. By the time I got to high school, a lot of my teachers really hated me. My high school English teacher, I almost failed high school English sophomore year because my teacher thought I cheated on a test of Mice and Men because she didn't think I was smart enough to get all the answers right. But I was in a John Steinbeck phase, so I was reading everything he wrote, and I just remembered all the details and understood it and loved it.
Have you sent her your books and then threw the words on it?
She was aware of it. I did write a blog post about it once and called her Mrs. X. And every once in a while when I do a reading, someone will still ask me to sign the book, Mrs. X Can Suck It, because I had posted that anytime I have a big moment, I would say, Mrs. X Can Suck It. So every once in a while, I still sign a book with that. But then when I got to college, not to get too into the weeds with it, but I had knee surgery when I was in high school and missed a year of school because my school wasn't handicapped accessible. Okay. And I ended up doing the second half of my junior year and my entire senior year in one semester. And it was the first time I ever made high honor roll. And I got into college and I took my SATs and, you know, got into every college I applied to after not having been a great student. And I had so many moments like that.
Allison, based on your SATs, so you were a good tester.
I'm not a good tester normally, but I did pretty well on my SATs and I did very well in writing my essays and I was really passionate and I'd done so well in school like that last year that it looked like I was really pulling myself together. And I was going to school for theater because I had done theater when I was younger and I didn't think I was good at anything else. You know, I thought, well, I can do this. This is something people go to school for. I really loved the teamwork of theater. So that's what I went to school for. And I went to Ithaca College for 2 years. And it was a great experience, except I just really didn't want to be an actor. But in that process, I was falling asleep in a gen ed class that I had to take. And I can't sleep in other places normally. I'm not a good sleeper. So the fact that I was falling asleep in a classroom was really concerning to me. And I went to my advisor and said, I think I have narcolepsy. And he sent me to academic support services for students with disabilities. And I was like, I don't have a disability. What is this? You know, but they pulled my records from grade school. And in fourth grade, it was written in the notes that I had ADHD. Yeah, it was just penciled in. I don't think anyone ever told anybody else about it, but it was like ADHD. Or it was ADD back then, but.
And so no one had told your parents?
Not that I know of.
That is so awful, but.
Yeah. So then I officially got a diagnosis by someone where I grew up outside of New York City named Dr. Kevin Calico, who changed my life completely. And I read Dr. Halliwell and Dr. Rady's book, and all of a sudden it was like, oh my gosh, the world makes sense to me. And yeah. I dropped out of college because I was like, I don't understand myself. I thought I wasn't a capable person. You know, I'd had IQ testing done and was proven that I'm very, very smart, but I didn't understand what that meant. I didn't understand who I was because everything about my development until I was, you know, 18, 19 years old was thinking I wasn't very bright, and I had to work really hard to just not show people that. So that was my big experience. And then over the years, you know, when I was diagnosed in, I think, 1996, a lot of the talk of attention deficit disorder was about how to be neurotypical. Mm-hmm. And so I always felt like, well, I could control my ADD, but that's the only thing I have the energy to do. And so I kind of started trying to ignore that I had attention deficit disorder so I could cope in the ways that I needed to. And eventually, like, I went back to school. I spent some time working in a biker bar. Like, I had kind of bummed around and was just aimless and shiftless and in some really bad situations. And then I finally went back to school, and that's when I started writing. But I was still out of touch with my attention deficit disorder because I really thought that that was just about being able to keep a schedule and keep your house clean. And, you know, and it was always about what I was lacking, even though I did understand that I had this really great brain if I learned how to use it. You know, I had a couple of times of going on medication and going off medication. I had a couple of times of trying really hard to be a good person with ADD. And then right before The People We Keep came out, I really couldn't get my act together. Our, you know, there was the pandemic. We moved into a house that needed a lot of work, and we were unpacking, and my new book was coming out, and I'd spent 15 years working on this book, and my dog passed away. Like, I just could not get myself together. It was so much. And I had a doctor who told me, you write books, you can't have ADHD. And I was like, oh, no, I write books because I have ADHD. And then I finally found a new doctor, and she suggested that I start looking into ADHD again, because the tone of how people talk about it has changed since I was diagnosed. And I found your podcast, and I found your interview with Dr. Halliwell, and was just, I felt like I was being saved. I felt like I was being explained to myself all over again. And then I read ADHD 2.0. And I went out and got another dog. I was like, Dr. Halliwell says I need a dog. I'm getting another dog.
And you love dogs, right? I noticed at least two books are about dogs, right?
Three books.
That's when I knew I love her.
You know, and reading your book was so great too, because I do think that the things I don't do well as a person with ADHD are not things that really matter. And the things that I do well with ADHD, if I stop trying to fix all the stuff that doesn't really matter, you know, lets me be myself, lets me be kind to other people. I'm not constantly operating at a deficit of like, I'm not good enough, or my office isn't clean enough to talk to Tracy. You know, it's like, it doesn't matter. It's this big. You can't see the rest of it. And just all the positivity that you put out and reading your book. Well, I listened to the audio, and I'm so impressed that you did your own audio. It was so incredible.
That was the easiest part about the whole process, Allison.
That's amazing.
Honestly, that was, they gave me 5 days and I did it in two.
You're incredible.
And people told me, oh, this is so hard work. Are you sure you want to do this? I'm like, but I'm a podcaster. That was the easiest thing. All the other stuff was so hard, but that was easy.
You did it beautifully though. And it just meant so much to me to spend that time in positivity about our brains. Like, that is absolutely life-changing.
That's so incredibly kind. Okay, so I guess we can go now to the writing part, because that's probably what everybody wants to know about. 80% of people want to write a book. A very, very small percentage of us actually do it. I have no idea how many people write three books. So clearly, you are a writer, and it sounds like you've always been a writer. That is what you love, right? Our books, reading, writing.
I've always loved books, and I was such a big reader, but I didn't know I could write, because when you're a kid my age, I'm 47, and we were writing on paper and handing in paper with pencil, and my papers always had arrows all over the place and eraser marks. And, you know, my handwriting was inconsistent. And so I thought I wasn't a good writer, and I didn't know how to capture my thoughts. I remember trying to write, I had this beautiful story in my head as a kid, and I was trying to write it down in a notebook, and it was, you know, like a nice notebook, and I didn't want to ruin it. And my handwriting was bad, and I couldn't get the story down. I started writing it. I knew what the end was, and I thought I knew the whole story. And when I sat down to write, I couldn't figure out, wait, what comes next? Wait, what comes next? And I didn't know how to capture that. So I just gave up. And it wasn't until I learned how to draft and how to just capture all of my ideas, no matter when they come up and how nonsensical they seem to me at the moment. That's when I was able to write. And that changed everything for me. But I did not know I could until I went back to school and I was like, you know, 24, 25 years old.
You know, I really love hearing that, because that was my biggest struggle too. And I thought, oh, well, I've got 200 and some odd podcast episodes. There's my book. I'll just do that. Well, no. And so it's exactly what you're saying. It's all these thoughts. And then in my brain, I'm thinking, okay, what's point one? And what's under point one? What's point two? And it's just so overwhelming. We so want to tell our story, whatever our story is, but to get it all organized, like, how did you do that? How did you figure? Because I'm still not sure I figured it out without an editor, like two editors. It's still overwhelming to me. Like, I still feel like I don't know how to write, even though I spent 2 years writing.
I mean, I still feel like that sometimes. And every book kind of needs something a little bit different. And every book needs different input for the output. And I think that that's something you have to figure out.
Well, and fiction, right? Fiction just seems way harder, because at least nonfiction, well, that was my life. I know these things, right? Versus you are creating out of nothing.
What's interesting, though, is that I have a harder time actually writing about what happened than I do with the freedom of fiction. And I think some of it's psychological, but some of it is just not being confined by possibility, but also being confined by what story is. I think those are confinements that are comfortable to me. Like, when I've tried to write things that are more like autofiction, like veiled fictional stories, the characters aren't believable. You know, like, it would need to be, people are a little over the top, and it would need to be nonfiction for those characters to work in that form, which is really interesting. But I have a hard time writing about the things that actually happened. I kind of tense up and don't feel the same creative freedom that my imagination gives me.
That makes perfect sense, actually.
You know, it's all about us knowing how our brains work and knowing what we have to offer the world and what puts us in a state of flow. And that's different for every person, even if they're writers. You know, we're both writers. We have different brains still.
So you said something and I just went like, ding, 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 ding. And I'm sure our listeners thought the same thing, but you said you didn't know how to capture your thoughts. So tell us, how did you learn how to capture your thoughts, and what is your process?
I did a writing exercise that became my first book in a class in college, where we had to write a scene, like just free writing. They give you like a little trigger sentence and you start writing there. And then we had to revise it 3 times. And in the 3rd revision, the secondary character became the primary character. And all of a sudden it taught me, like, oh, what you put down first, you can change dramatically. You can put something down and then say, what if I look at it from a different angle? What if I change the setting? What if I change who's talking? I change the time period. I change the tense, you know, like, what gets us there? And then as a theater major, I was taught to kind of ask questions about character all the time, to get to know your character, to have that make sense. And the combination of the two, like putting those two things together, taught me that I could play in the concept of story, that I didn't have to sit down and know what I was doing. I just had to start. And then once you get something down on the paper, you're like, well, what happened before that? Who are these people? What is that novel, The People We Keep, that I started writing when I was writing my first novel, Stay? I was just sitting there listening to music, and all of a sudden I had this idea of a woman who takes things and leaves things everywhere she goes. And I wrote this scene about a woman leaving a sweater in a motel room. And I knew that the sweater was really important to her, but she was trying to pretend that it wasn't. I didn't know who it belonged to. I didn't know the story behind it. And that's in the middle of The People We Keep now, that scene. Because I said, who is this woman? Where is she going? And then I wrote that. And then it was like, okay, but where did she come from? Why is she the way she is? And then I wrote the beginning of the book.
What you're saying is that scene with the sweater is where the book ultimately came from.
Yes.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. And I think once you get used to that idea, you feel entitled to write down the little ideas that you have. I had a note, a post-it I found a while ago where I had just written down, he brings her a cannoli. It was just like a little thing. And I just wrote it down. And then there's a scene about it. It was a calzone, not a cannoli. As you're having ideas about a scene, as you're starting to think about something, you think of more details. Mm. And it's okay to just write those details down. Even if you don't feel like sitting down and writing the whole scene, it's okay to just have stacks of post-it notes everywhere, or the backs of envelopes, or I have famously written on things that I needed to turn in, you know, sending a bill to the electric company with like white out all over it after I took a picture of it.
This is so interesting because I think that what we often struggle with most is perfectionism. And if it can't be perfect, we can't do it, right? And what you're saying is exactly the opposite. That might be the start of your whole book.
Yes. Yeah. And I think creative people, you know, we get words stuck in our heads. We get, for me, I have images in my head. Like I have a very visual mind. And I think that a lot of times when I'm talking, I'm actually translating the visuals. So sometimes when I'm super tired, I have like speech delays and things, you know, where I'm like, trying to translate from a visual language to a verbal one, which is what I'm doing when I'm writing also, you know, which is something I hadn't really thought about until I started exploring ADHD more because of you, is starting to think about, okay, actually, how does my brain work when I'm struggling? Why am I struggling? But a lot of times I'll just get stuck on like a texture. You know, one of the things that's in The People We Keep is like the way it feels to walk on pine needles. You know, I would just start to think about that very specifically, what it smells like, what it feels like. And that, you know, that's in the book. It's like all these tiny little things that might not seem important just build images. Or if you don't think in pictures, I know a lot of people who write have like aphantasia and don't think in pictures, yeah, and they're beautiful writers. So yeah, your brain doesn't have to work a certain way to write. But however it does, you can capture things that seem insignificant. But just, you can't let go of them, you know?
Is it really hard for you, though, you have this idea and you see it, to then translate it into the written word, but where it fully captures what you see? Like, I really struggle with that. It's never as good.
It's really hard and it takes a long time. You know, I think that's the other thing, is that we tend to want to rush things. I think a lot of times with people with ADHD, we've been told we don't finish things, and that starts to build up as, shoot, I have to finish this. You know, I have to rush. I have to finish this, or I'm not a finisher. I have to finish this, or I'm not a writer. But I spent 15 years working on The People We Keep. And a lot of that was other people telling me what it should be, and me having that, you know, ADHD sense of righteousness about things where I just couldn't. And so a lot of that was battle, but a lot of it was just painting with a very fine brush. It doesn't actually matter how long my book took. I wrote other things in that time too. I wrote 3 books in the time that I started The People We Keep.
Can I ask you, on The People We Keep, you say it took 15 years. So was that the book that you really wanted to write?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so before we go there, let's start with, wait, what was the first one called?
Stay.
Stay, the dog.
Yes.
Okay, so I want to know, how did Stay come about? And then what was your process for actually getting it published? It was traditionally published, right?
Yes.
So how did all that work? How old were you? You know, all the things everybody's going to want to know who's sitting there saying, I've got a book in me.
Yeah, Stay came out in 2010. Mm-hmm. I had quit writing for a couple of years. It started in that class. It was a writing exercise, and I'd quit writing for a couple of years. And then I thought, all I have to do is go back and write that short story, like finish that short story that I'd written based on the writing exercise. And then I'll get that published, and that'll be the start of my career. And I kept sending it out and getting not quite. And in that time, I joined a writing group, and we had 8 pages a week due. And so, you know, if you didn't have your pages, it was embarrassing. And I was working, you know, a full-time job, And I think our writing group was on like a Monday or a Tuesday. And on Sunday nights, I would sit down and just kind of download what I'd been thinking about all week and try to get as close to 8 pages as I could. And I thought I was still writing a short story. And a couple years into it, 70,000 words into it, my writing group's like, you are not writing a short story anymore. I just kept thinking, I just need to know more and then I'll get this story right. And I ended up just writing a whole book. So I kind of tricked myself into it. And then I had a book. And back then, to query an agent, I mean, I was living up in Rochester, New York, and I didn't really know too many people in publishing. And so I'd have to send out query letters where you're writing what your book is about and sending it to an agent. And it took about a year of getting rejected, which was really hard, except that's also where having a dog came in really handy, because you get rejected, you know, they would come through the mail and I'd go to the mailbox and I'd get a rejection and I'd walk back in the house and my dog would be so happy to see me. And it just took the sting out. It was like, okay, I'm back in the moment here. This is also important.
So can I ask you, when you write a nonfiction book, you have to do a book proposal with all the chapter summaries. I think when you do fiction, you have to write the book, right? And so you send the book off.
Yeah. Well, and a lot of times you're just sending off a letter that's saying, here's what my book's about. Do you think you might want to read it? So it's, and then sometimes they'll say, well, send me the first chapter. And then they'll like the first chapter and say, okay, send me the rest of it. So, and back then it was mostly on paper, which was really frustrating. So that's changed a little bit. I remember it's such an ADHD thing, but you used to have to send a self-addressed stamped envelope. And I would always end up sending my letters back to myself because I'd reverse the envelope. So I'd send it out and like 2 days later, I'd get a letter back and I'd be like, oh, this is it. And then it was just me.
I loved it so much that it's so quick. Yeah. Okay. As far as that first book. So then it took a year.
It took a year to get an agent. And then I think it took another.
Oh, it took a year to get an agent.
Yes.
And then how long did it take him or her to actually get the offer?
It took her about, I think, 4 to 6 months, something like that. You know, and then the whole time, people knew I was doing that. So it was like, oh, when's your book coming out? And it's like, I don't know. So it was a lot to go through. And then it did actually come out. And that was really exciting. And then I wanted to publish The People We Keep. And everyone was like, what the heck is this? You write dog books.
Oh.
Could you put a dog in it? Could you make the main character more likable?
Oh, really? So your first book is successful. They want you to write another book, but you still can't write the book you want to write.
Yeah.
And so you said, okay, and you went ahead and did two and then...
Yeah, and I love those books. I love those books. I'm very proud of them. They're fun. And I tried to put a lot of gravitas into rom-coms, basically. You know, I tried to really ground them in reality, and I'm really proud of them, and I love them, and I loved writing them. But this is the book I needed to write. I had a lot of times where people wanted me to compromise that vision, and I had a lot of angst about that. It was actually really very hard. And sometimes I would try. I'd have an agent. I've gone through 5 agents now, and a lot of times I would try to, they'd say like, if you make these changes, I know I can sell the book. And then they'd make those changes and they couldn't sell the book because it didn't work. Mm. And when I did that, I felt like I was betraying my main character, which is probably just me betraying myself, you know?
Yeah. So that's so interesting, because I was going to ask you, you know, is it the same publisher? Is it the same agent? But it sounds like 5 agents. Talk about that.
I think, you know, one of the things I'm starting to see is how hard it is as a neurodivergent person to communicate with neurotypical people, which I feel like partly I almost shouldn't be saying, but I think that's a huge part of it.
I love that, especially in publishing. Mm-hmm. There is no place where there are more linear brains.
Yes.
And I personally think I got lucky because my agent, I don't know if she's been diagnosed, but she has ADHD. She could completely relate to everything that I was trying to do. And I also believe that my acquiring editor, although she's never said I have ADHD, I believe she has ADHD too. She's somewhere on that spectrum, right? And, but she was still like, everybody around her was so linear. And it's hard because you really feel like you're giving up a part of yourself, right?
Yeah.
Just to kind of make sure that they're happy. And there's a lot of things, and it's different, I think, fiction versus nonfiction. And I'm so grateful for them because they knew what I needed to do to get this book out there and make it successful, even though I didn't want to do it their way. But yeah, because they were so successful, I just kind of, okay, well, you know what you're doing, right? You know? But in a lot of ways, you know, there's so much that, you know, this story would be cut and a month later, 2 months, 3 months, I'm like, wait, what happened to that? Like, I couldn't even keep track anymore of all the changes. And I just had to let it go. And I'd love to know what your experience is, how that ties into the five agents. And then also, do you finally feel like you found the team that maybe works best with your neurodivergent brain?
You know, I think that there's times in publishing where everything works perfectly. And that was definitely the case for the people we keep. And that was wonderful. But I think that it's such a changing industry all the time so that you can't rely on that. You know, you have to kind of the same way you have to look at every book as a new experience as a writer and figure out what the book needs. You know, you kind of have to do that all the way through, I think, depending, you know, if you're lucky, maybe not. Yeah, I think, thank goodness there are people who are linear who can push certain things through.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, I've done a lot of research on it because, of course, that's like my special interest, you know, is creativity and art for commerce. And, you know, if you start to think about it, you can hear that angst and read that angst and watch it in movies. You see it everywhere. All of a sudden you start to hear it in songs. You start to, it's in movies. It sneaks out in fiction. That it's a very hard thing to be a creative person that then intersects with business. That's very hard. I think that a lot of people are very well intentioned in terms of thinking that they understand your vision. But if your vision isn't fully actualized yet, that's what I learned with the people we keep. You might have a very firm idea of where you're going, but it's very hard to get people who are neurotypical on board with your creative vision if it's not actualized. And so I would take the people we keep to my writer friends and they would say, it's brilliant. And they're the kind of people who will tell you if it's not, you know, like they're not holding back on that. And then I would take it to an agent and they'd want to change all these other things. The other thing that happened in that process is the Me Too movement happened. Mm. And all of a sudden it wasn't acceptable anymore to say your main character is not nice enough.
Wait, what? What?
Could you make her nicer? That was a note I was getting over and over again.
Why? Why did that relate to the Me Too movement? I don't understand.
Because once we started talking, like before that, there was very much this idea of like women having to be nice, that we wanted our characters to be nice, that there was like a certain code of conduct. And my main character was outside of that. And then all of a sudden, we started talking about women and niceness. And I think I'm maybe losing the thread of the question that you asked me in answering this, but I think that actually changed perspectives because we just started talking about women having reasons for their behavior.
I never even thought of that, but it makes perfect sense. So they could be, your characters could be real women.
Yes.
That aren't always nice.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
We're not always nice.
Yeah. That's not a comment I got after that. But before that, in the fight, it was like they wanted my main character to be more like a Disney princess. And afterwards, they didn't. And so, I mean, that's a lot of something I think that people need to realize as a person with ADHD, as a person with neurodivergence, like your vision is worthwhile. It might just not be the right time or place for it. Mm. Mm-hmm. And you can keep crafting it and working on it so that when you bring it to someone, it's, you know, like undeniable. And that's what happened with the people we keep. When I finally had it crafted to a certain point where it showed what I was thinking so clearly that I didn't need a creative person to come in and see what it could be. You know, they were seeing what it was. And it was also just the right time for it. So I think that we get discouraged by the no's and rejection. And of course, you know, rejection sensitive dysphoria is a thing. But I think that our work is valid, whether or not it's the right time or whether or not it's fully actualized yet. If we have a vision, we can just stick to it and keep getting the details down and chipping away at it and building something. But it just takes time.
So the people we keep, where did that come from? Like, why was it so important for you to write that book?
I feel like, you know, it's about a 16-year-old folk singer who steals a car and hits the road. She grows up in a motorless motorhome. I grew up outside of New York City and not in a house, I've never stolen a car. I did play guitar for a little while when I was younger, but never professionally. And I play guitar a little bit now too, but, you know, not trying to be a musician. It's like my dopamine fix. I feel like it made sense of my life in allegory in some way. I feel like I got to paint with all the feelings that I've ever had about not fitting in, about the people I felt like I belonged to and the people I didn't feel like I belonged to. And I didn't know I was doing it. And then after I wrote it, I could say, oh, I wrote this because of that. Oh, I wrote this because of an experience. Like, there's a scene where my main character is someone who she meets is teaching her how to waltz. And I was actually reading part of that scene at one point in a book event and almost started crying because I remembered my voice teacher when I was in college teaching me how to waltz because I couldn't get the waltz tempo. And I thought, well, that's where I pulled that texture from. That's where that came from. I was pulling that feeling of belonging and putting it into the book. You know, I wasn't necessarily writing about him. I wasn't, you know, writing about that moment specifically, but it's like, I'm sure you have this too of noticing so much and being so aware and taking in so much information all the time. And I'd done that my whole life. And then all of a sudden, this was the moment for it. You know, this was how I used it. I took all those colors and put them into that painting.
How did you go from this light, airy, fairy kind of rom-coms involving dogs to something that is so serious, so intense, so I just read the reviews and I started crying from the reviews. You know, I'm like, I can't do this.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I've had a fair amount of trauma in my life and a lot of difficulty in my life. And I think that it had to go somewhere. You know, I actually, when I finished the first draft of the book, I felt a lot more calm. Like, I felt like a different person. I think that it was part of me processing things that I'd gone through.
Yeah. Yeah. So our best purposes give meaning to our past, right?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
And I'm sure what this book is doing too is helping other women process what they've gone through.
That is, I think, the most life-changing thing about this whole process is realizing that when you write something you feel genuinely and you put your full self into something, that it can be the most helpful to somebody else. You know, that it's made me appreciate work that feels like that too, even more, because I know what it took for me to put that kind of honesty and feeling and attention and love into a book. And so it's made me feel more connected to other artists who do that too. But it's also just been incredible. I don't think I've met a single person who loved my book that I didn't love instantly, you know, which is kind of an amazing thing.
Yeah. No, well, when you raise your hand, right, your people discover that, oh, wait, she's my people. Right?
Yes. Yeah, I'm sure you've so much had that experience.
Yeah. I mean, there's no way if we're not talking about these things, writing about these things, nobody's going to know we're their people.
Yes. And that, I think, is such a big thing in an industry that's trying to make you for everyone and just a general culture of trying to make you for everyone. And if you're some sort of, you know, if you're not, then you've failed in some way. Like, I'm not for everyone. I'm just not. But if I try to be, then I miss out on the people that I'm for and they're for me.
What would it feel like to jump out of bed every morning in love with your career, your relationships, your life? If you find yourself lying awake at night wondering, who am I really? What would make me the kind of happy that doesn't fade after 2 months? Why am I clear on what I don't want to do, but clueless about how to figure out what I do want? Then join me for my free What Do I Do With My Life Masterclass, where we'll talk about how to become the expert on you, and make better, quicker, and more confident decisions in your personal and professional life? Which of the many ideas that you have is the one you should actually pursue? And what would it really look like for you to live to your full potential? If this sounds like a fit for you, join me for my free What Do I Do With My Life Masterclass by going to spyhappy.me/class. See you there. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So clearly The People We Keep is the book that you are most proud of.
Yes.
Ah, what's the next book? Is there one? You must be working on something,
I am.
Right?
I'm always working on a couple of things. So yeah, my next book is called Home of the American Circus. I'm not sure when it's going to be out yet, but it's called Home of the American Circus. And it's about a woman who moves back to her hometown, and she's been estranged from her family, but she inherits a house and has to move back to her hometown. And it takes place in my hometown of Somers, New York, which is a little nervy to have to write about where you grew up. But there's like circus history, and the first circus elephant who came to the United States is kind of part of the lore of the town, and was really meaningful to me as a kid, being sensitive and realizing that a captive elephant is always a tragedy in this town that just like celebrated the circus history and the elephant. Yeah. So I kind of wanted to put that backdrop in the book to deal with what it means to be a sensitive person in the world. And my characters aren't diagnosed, but my main character is very neurodivergent. And I really leaned into the experience of that in writing it.
So it's already done.
Yes. Yeah. I finished it. Yeah.
Oh, okay. How many books are you typically working on at one time?
Probably like 5, if I think about it, but they're in various stages. Like some of them are just notes. Some of them are like a couple conversations where I'm like, maybe I'll go back to that.
How do you find a writing group? Because it really sounds like, especially for our brains, if this is something we want to do, that's probably one of the best uses of our time, right?
Yeah, it was really helpful for me. You know, I did eventually get to a point where I was writing professionally and I had to write much faster than 8 pages a week. And and then we moved away. And so, you know, now I have other friends that I exchange manuscripts with, and that's really helpful. And I think editorial feedback from other writers is really always the most helpful and really important to get. I found mine from like a community writing class. And then when that course ended, a couple of us got together. You know, it's very hard to find the right combination of people. And I think that that's important to know because, you know, at one point I had someone who said to me, I don't like the book you're writing. Like, I don't like what you're writing. I don't like your main character. I don't think she's redeemable. I'm not sure you are. Like, it was so violent in language.
I don't think you are? That's uncalled for.
It was definitely a situation of like a jealousy type of, like, I was the youngest person in the group. And it was like, who does this kid think she is, you know, which is horrible. But I think that that's something not to deter people, but to be aware of, that if you go into a group and it is not working for you, you know, one of the things that we would do when we had a few good people in the group and we tried someone else is we would just say, oh, we're going to take a break for a while. And then we just like reassemble with the people who were constructive. Like, it is one of the things in writing, they always teach you like, oh, you got to have a tough skin, kid. You know, like you have to protect your gentle heart. You have to protect that part of you that feels so intensely. Yeah. However you need to do it so you can do the work, because that's really important. You know, you can't do the work when you're all armored up.
Absolutely. So it's like anything with ADHD, right? If we're not in positive emotion, then we're just protecting ourselves and we're feeling all this negative emotion, and that doesn't help the creative process at all.
Exactly. Exactly. Or our mental health. It's, you know, we should try to find communities of people who are going to take care of our hearts if we want to do creative work. I mean, just in general, like, we shouldn't be fighting against everything that's around us. So that's very important. And that's actually, I just started a creative community on Patreon called the True Hearts Collective. That is, we have Zoom meetings where we talk about creativity and interview, you know, I'm interviewing creative people. We have like a little film club we're going to do just to talk about consuming art and making art. And it's, you know, I'm a writer, so it's very specific to writers in some ways, but we have, you know, people who do fiber arts or visual arts or music also, because it's really not about me saying, here's how you get published, here's how you be a writer, here's how you write a book. It's saying, here's how we struggle as creative people. How can we support each other? And my hope is that that's an organization that will help people find other creative people where they can find their own writing group as well. And just kind of not audition, but just test out, like, are you a safe person for me? I think you might be a safe person for me. Because with the people we keep, I had so much support from other writers saying, you're onto something. This is good. No, don't make those changes. And that made a whole difference in my life. And I feel like a lot of people who are writing don't have that support. I had that support because I wrote three other books and I met other writers along the way. But if you're starting out with your opus and you don't have people to support you who know what they're doing, you know, who can give you real helpful feedback, it's very easy to get bullied. It's very easy to lose what you love about your work.
I can't even imagine with fiction. Although maybe it's worse with nonfiction because it's all true, but to give it to someone, oh my God, it's just mortifying, right? And again, those neurotypicals in publishing, they're not kind about their feedback at all. The one thing I kept hearing is, Tracy, we're protecting you. They're going to hate you if you tell this story. And I'm like, but it was true. I mean, by the time it was over, I wasn't allowed to have an Apple Watch. I wasn't allowed to ride a Peloton. I was like, it was just anything that smacked even this much of any kind of wealth, you know, had to be gone. Oh. And so they created stories that wasn't my story. You know, that's not my house is. Like, I couldn't have a place where my Peloton was, like a separate room. So they put it in the garage. And I'm like, if someone asked me that story, I'm going to have to lie because I can't even remember where you, and it would just like so stupid, but it would grate on me.
Of course it would.
Now, though, I mean, I've heard a couple comments about wealth because apparently it still came out, but I'm glad because I've had comments even about that, right? And so I kind of see where they were coming from now. They just didn't want the book. I just read a book where it was just all about, like, it was so clear, like, you know, none of us could relate to her life and what was going on. And oh my God, that poor woman just, you know, torn to shreds for it.
Oof.
And in my mind, I'm like, that's not fair. You know, we all come in with different, obviously, privileges, right?
Yes.
And so to tear her down just because of, she didn't have anything to do with who her dad was, you know, maybe she could have toned it down a little bit, but I still, like, I struggle with all of that.
I think that is very much speaking to the fact that we're not all for everybody.
Yeah.
You know, I think that that's a lot of it, is that it's okay to speak to the people that we're for and not the, and I think one of the things I appreciate about you is how open you are and how you bring other perspectives into your community and your world and the Facebook group, you know, so you have one perspective, but you're not discounting other people's perspectives either.
And I just feel like, okay, we are all born, you know, with different privilege. Absolutely. And I see that, you know, and so I feel like my job then is to help those who were born with less, right? And to make life easier for everyone. So can we understand that without being so mean to each other and tearing each other down because it's different, right? Anyway, where do they find you as far as the Patreon that you were talking about?
It is patreon.com/AllieLarkinWrites, which is also Allie Larkin Writes is my Instagram handle. And I'm on Threads. I'm on Twitter, but I'm not really on Twitter anymore. Oh, I guess it's not even called that, which is sad.
X. Yeah, I don't even go on it anymore. And I used to love it. But again, it's just so mean now, right? I can't take all this meanness. Can't we just understand that people are different and we don't have to be mean? We can have an opinion, but we don't have to be mean. So before I let you go, I would love to know, what are the ADHD traits that you feel are responsible for your success?
I think that constellation thinking that I thought was not my asset is actually my asset. I think that the fact that I was uncomfortable as a child who didn't quite fit in means that my imagination never stopped developing. You know, it's like, it's adaptive. When I didn't want to be somewhere, I pretended I was somewhere else. And whether or not that's healthy, that saved me. And I have a very strong imagination muscle because of that. And I love that. I'm very thankful for it. I also think that I love neurodivergent people. Mm-hmm. And I feel that I can connect on a level that maybe I wouldn't be able to if I didn't have this brain. Because, you know, we're not doing the small talk. We're diving right in. I'm thankful for that. I feel like I have meaningful friendships and meaningful relationships with the world. And I think that that's a part of my attention deficit disorder too.
Yeah. Yeah. So I had at the top of my notes when we first started, inattentive, hyperactive. And of course, I forgot to ask, are you primarily inattentive or are you combined type?
I am primarily, you know, I was diagnosed with ADD specifically when I was younger. I have found though, you know, because my brain races very much so, but I have found, you know, I've got my little fidget here. You know, I need to have a certain level of exercise every day. I have a hard time sitting still, you know, so I don't know that I'm just inattentive. Inattentive doesn't really make sense either. It's the whole ADHD being a misnomer to begin with. It's I'm not inattentive. I spent 15 years working on a book. I'm selectively attentive.
And then even if we are inattentive, it's exactly what you said. We're bouncing from here to here to here to there and noticing, you know, it's like, is that really inattention? That sounds a lot like hyperactivity to me of the brain, right?
Yes. Yes. I think it actually is. And I think that is the whole thing. When you're going from here to here to here, just write it down on an envelope. Like if it's, oh, I have a story idea. Oh, what about that? Oh, I could write a screenplay about that. Like just write all of it down and then figure out a way to organize it.
So everything is Allie Larkin Writes on all the platforms.
Yes.
Is there anything else that you wanted to say about what you're working on or where you want to send people?
You know, the one thing I didn't mention, which is promoting something that's not me, is that I use Scrivener to write.
You do?
I do. And I think that that's an important way to collect thoughts.
I tried Scrivener years ago. How long did it take you to get it? Or did you take a class in it? Or how did you figure it out?
I did some YouTube tutorials that helped because it can do so much, but you only really need it to do what you need it to do. So you just have to figure out what that is and not get overwhelmed. But I was very overwhelmed for a while and avoided it. But it's super simple once you know. I'll teach you. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I was all over the place. I was Google Docs, which is it's a mess. But then I don't know if all publishers are like this, but they made me write in Word. And after 2 years, I still don't know Word.
Word is really difficult. Like, and I end up having to convert my files into Word later, but I find it really helpful in organizing all of my thoughts to just be able to move the files around in Scrivener. So I guess I'm pitching Scrivener here, but I think it's important because it's been really helpful to me. But there's a barrier to entry in terms of learning.
Yeah. That's what I wanted because, like you said, how you can store all your notes for every chapter. And it made so much sense, but then I couldn't figure it out. I probably didn't give it enough time. And all the real writers use Scrivener. So clearly, there's something good, right?
For your next book, I'll help you.
Oh, gosh. Allison, thank you so much for spending time with us here today. It was such a privilege to meet you.
Oh, Tracy, this is amazing to get to meet you. Thank you so much. And just thank you for being you and having this podcast.
Well, thank you. So that's all we have for this week. If you liked this episode with Allison, please let us know by leaving a review. Our goal, you know, it's to change the conversation around ADHD, helping as many women as we possibly can learn how their ADHD brains work so that they too may discover their amazing strengths. Thank you so much for listening. I'll see you here next week. And don't forget, go order Allie's book.
The People We Keep.
The People We Keep. I'm sure it's on all the platforms. You've been listening to the ADHD for Smartass Women podcast. I'm your host, Tracy Otsuka. Join us at ADHDforSmartWomen.com, where you can find more information on my new book, ADHD for Smartass Women, and my patented Your ADHD Brain is A-OK system to help you get unstuck and fall in love with your brilliant brain. It's me again, Tracy. You know how people often assume that if you have ADHD, you're just lazy, unmotivated, and not living up to your full potential? Well, I'm here to tell you they've got it all wrong, except for the part about not reaching your full potential. But that's only because you haven't found the right strategies tailored for your unique ADHD brain. And that's exactly why I wrote ADHD for Smart-Ass Women. This book, it's designed to help you understand the different approaches that work for your distinct brain, inspiring you to become the best version of yourself right now. You can grab a copy wherever books are sold. And if you've already read my book, please take a moment to leave a review on Amazon and Goodreads. Your feedback, it not only supports me and my publisher, but it also helps other smart-ass women and their kids, friends, and colleagues find the strategies they need to thrive. Every review makes a huge difference. So go write a review now or buy the book now before you forget. Okay, back to our usual programming.